Rick Stevens, financial advisor with FRS Financial Group. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. For more detailed information regarding any of the topics discussed on today's show, please call 719-500-8700. This is Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial. Here's your host, Rick Stevens.
Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial Group. I am your host, Rick Stevens, and remember that this is your show. Folks, if you have got questions that you would like to have answered on a future episode of Money Matters, if there is a particular topic you would like to hear more about, please feel free to give me a call at 719-500-8700. Send me an email, rstevens@frsfinancialgroup.com, or simply go to that website, frsfinancialgroup.com. Click that contact tab up in that top right-hand corner. Send that question, send that topic, send us a message. We would love to hear from you. Well, folks, this week on Money Matters, I am joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Andrew Rogers. Andrew, how are we?
Oh, you called me pretty.
I did.
Thank you.
You know what? It happens when, you know, I can be in a good mood when the Bears actually played well the week before and the Packers lost.
Yes, we can both celebrate that.
that's a good way to start a week. You know, that kind of brings me to a little bit on, you know, what we're going to talk about on today's show.
Okay.
And that's things in your money world that matter and things that don't matter. And as a couple guys that root for football teams in the NFC North, we know that you lose to somebody maybe outside of your division. It's not fun, but ultimately it doesn't matter as much as watching, say, Green Bay lose.
Yeah.
Because that is what matters.
Yeah. It's the difference between having a one-game lead over everyone or a two-game lead over everyone. Three in some cases.
Right. Right, not that there's any team in Honolulu Blue that is sporting a lead like that in a division. So
looking good,
they are, but don't say that out loud because you know anything could happen because we've seen anything happen.
It's like Ted Lasso says, it's the hope that gets you. I'm a little worried about that right now. I'm worried about the hope.
Ah, yes. Well, folks, that's where we are going this week. We are talking about, in the money world, some of those things that matter, some of those things that, quite frankly, given the big picture, don't matter. I know there are a lot of folks out there that fret and worry about different things, and some of those worries, Andrew, matter. Some of those don't matter as much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we kind of keep that football analogy going, for Broncos fans, yes, losing to the Dolphins hurt. Right?
Historically hurt, but
the defense gave that up. But that doesn't matter nearly as much as, say, a game against a particular team that wears red and yellow. That game matters more.
Oh, Taylor Swift's boyfriend and his friends?
Yes, that thing. Or you know, we kind of talked about, you know, the Bears, and you know, the Bears beating Washington last week didn't matter nearly as much as watching Green Bay lose.
Yeah.
You know, I know that pretty much every Bears fan out there would tell you they're okay to see that team go 2-15 as long as those two are against Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
That would make for an okay season.
Yeah.
As long as you beat Green Bay, that's all that matters. As we are getting to the hockey season, right?
Yeah.
As a Red Wing fan, I know that, you know, if they beat the Panthers sometime during the regular season, they take out that team from Florida, that's nice. It doesn't matter in the grand scheme as much as, you know, playing a certain team to our north and scoring more goals than they do.
You mean the Nordiques?
Yes, those Quebecers.
It would be nice if we could get back to that.
Yes. So there
this
are
might
things.
Might be the year.
Hey, you never know. You never know.
Got to trust the Iser plan.
Hey, at least your number one draft pick, the number one pick overall, didn't try to come out to begin the game without his stick. Did you see that?
Yeah, but he ended up still getting a point.
It's true.
And, I mean, they still got the win.
It's true, but the stick's kind of important. That's one of those things. That's one of those things you need to remember to take to the ice with you if you're playing hockey.
Yeah,
it comes in handy. So, folks, we are talking about all kinds of things that matter, things that don't matter. We're going to do that this week through the lens of your money.
Because your money matters, right?
It does. Your money matters. It's like you've heard the tagline of the show or something. We're talking about these things. And before we actually kind of jump into what we kind of have laid out here, Andrew, I want to talk a little bit about the spending of money. And, you know, as I talk to folks oftentimes, what I will tell them is, you know what, if you need a car, the fact that you need reliable transportation is what matters.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily matter which sort of reliable transportation you choose.
Yeah.
It doesn't exactly matter if you've chosen a 2012 Camry or a 2015 F-150 or a 2018 whatever. Needing the reliable transportation is the big piece.
Yeah.
There are things that don't matter out there. I discovered this, though. Just recently, I'm going to be, you know, headed back to Southern Illinois later this fall to drive my dad's truck, if I have to call it, you know, the way that I talk about my truck in Montana, to drive my dad's truck back that will be parked at my house. So I'm flying out there. I'm looking at airline tickets, and I'm looking at that, and, you know, like most folks, I'm looking at airline tickets and I'm judging them based on price because I'm flying Denver to St. Louis and it's a one way. And I'm intending to fly the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
I actually found a really good deal.
Yeah.
On United, in the economy class, was $80 one way.
Whew.
Now,
that is good.
With that, though, if you're flying coach, you're flying economy, you have to pay for your bags. Part of this trip is my hunting trip. So I would have to check my weapon to have it gone with me. And because I will be gone about 10 days, I have a fair amount of clothes that will be in a bag to get checked.
Mm-hmm.
Two checked bags is an additional $80. So $160 total for economy plus two bags. Or, Andrew, did you know that if you buy a first class ticket, you get two bags for free?
No, I didn't.
Yes, on United. You know what the price of a first-class ticket on United was?
Probably, what, $160?
$140. Oh. It was cheaper. So part of me is going, I'm not sure how United is doing this math. They're going to give me a bigger seat with more leg room at the front of the plane and the ability to get on first and those two bags.
And a few beverages.
And some beverages, you know, maybe some pretzels for a snack, peanuts, who knows. And it's cheaper. That was something that matters. Now, first class in general to me doesn't matter. I really could care less. I just want to be able to sit and get to wherever I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
So how I get there didn't really matter, but holy cow, if you actually look, you can find some weird deals like that every once in a while.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. So there are things that matter, things that don't matter. One of those things that, and oftentimes I have this conversation with folks that matters when we're thinking about our retirement years, is we can't just save money anymore, Andrew. We can't just stick that money in the coffee can and bury it in the backyard like our grandparents or great-grandparents did. We can't even, quite frankly, anymore just put our money in the bank and let it sit there to do that. We actually have to invest if we are looking to that retirement future. And the reason that investing matters now is compounding growth.
Okay.
Right? It's the growth of the growth of the money. That's the compounding thing. And it all starts, Andrew, with this fun little thing called the Rule of 72.
Okay. What is the Rule of 72?
I am glad you asked. The Rule of 72 says this, and folks, this is how the calculus works. And if you don't like calculus, well, that's the rule of 72. So the calculus is baked in. Is you take whatever that rate of growth is, whether that's a rate of return on your stock portfolio, your bonds, maybe it's the interest rate on a CD that you have or your savings account. You take that number, divide 72 by that number, and that tells you how many compounding periods, and typically we talk about it in terms of years, how many compound periods it takes for your money to double without you adding anything to it.
Okay.
So I always tell folks I like the basic math, right?
Yeah.
72, I'm going to round that to 70 because that's the closest big whole number on there. So if I am getting a 7% return, 70 divided by 7 is 10. That means it's going to take 10 years for that to happen. Or if I'm getting a 10% return, that means 70 divided by 10 is 7. It's going to take 7 years for that to happen.
Okay.
If I get a 70 divided by 35, that means it's going to take 2 years for that to happen. So it tells me how quickly things are going to double without me having to do any of the add more money into this piece. Now, years ago, when our parents, our grandparents, even our great-grandparents were younger and were just saving money to have some for a rainy day, you know, because way back when, and we'll talk about this later on that retirement planning part, but way back when they had pensions so they could just put money away and save it, banks used to pay a lot more interest on your savings accounts.
Even compared to this small snapshot where we're actually seeing higher than normal rates when it comes to those savings accounts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, if you look at what some of those average rates were over a large period of time, you go back to 1970 to 1985, okay, 15-year time frame in there. On average, during that entire 15 years, savings accounts were paying 10.125%, right? Be above 10%, your savings accounts on average were paying. When that happens, your money basically doubles every 7 years. So what that means is in 1970, you put $10,000 into a savings account. By 1985, 15 years later, you had $40,000. You didn't add anything to it. That's a pretty solid return on a savings account.
Mm-hmm.
But then we move into a little bit closer to our time frame. From 1986 to 1999, your interest rates were only averaging 6% in that time frame, which meant it took 12 years for that money to double. So if in 1986 you put that same $10,000 into the savings account, by 1999, you had $20,000. So basically a similar length of time frame out there, 15 years. 70 to 85, you got $40,000 out of it. But 86 to 99, you got $20,000 out of it. The magic of compounding, or the illusion of what used to be compounding. The memory of that. Then we get into the current century. We get to our 21st century, and we look at it from 2000 through 2011.
Okay.
In that time frame, your average rate over that time frame in a savings account was 3.6%. So now it took 20 years for your money to be able to double. So if in 2000 you put that $10,000 into that savings account, by 2011 you had $15,000. You see how we keep going sideways and south with this?
Yeah.
Which brings us to kind of where we're at today. Even with rates where they're at right now, even with some decent passbook savings these days, if we take 2012 through 2023, your average interest rate per year is not even a percent. It's 0.92%. Now, I'm not necessarily the greatest math wizard on the planet.
Yeah.
But if I'm dividing 72 by something less than 1, I'm coming up with something bigger than 72. So at this point, if the rates were right where they've been really the last decade, it's going to take me 78 years for my money to double based on those rates. And if I put $10,000 in the bank in 2012, by 2023, I have a little more than $11,000. That's a big difference.
That is.
Now, compared to what we saw in the 70s through the mid-80s, but a lot of folks still remember that 70s through the mid-80s.
Yeah. But why is it that it went that way? What made that wholesale change other than everything that happened in the 70s? Because we see it continuing through, you know, the mid-80s into 90s where it's still higher. What made that wholesale change where just simply saving wasn't enough?
Well, a lot of that comes in two spots. One was the philosophy of the Federal Reserve. They went from really, really high Federal Reserve rates and brought it down, 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 down. And we've seen those rates obviously ebb and flow over the years. Part of that deals with what the Fed is trying to do to either stimulate or pull back on the economy. If you want to stimulate growth in the economy, you want to encourage more borrowing, you drop the rates to make the cost of money cheaper. If you want people to slow down their borrowing, you're raising the rates. You're raising the rates out there to say, hey, don't borrow nearly as much. So that's a piece of it. Another part of that, actually, though, is in the 1970s, we started to actually see this really cool thing come into play. And it was a thing called a retirement plan. They were 401ks where the average person could be an investor. And again, they've pulled money away from just saving into banks and started to actually put it into stock market pieces, right? Whether those were stocks, whether those were bonds, we got to really see the use of things like mutual funds really start to come into play, because 401ks are now starting to gain some momentum, and companies are starting to go, you know what, we're not going to be able to get this interest rate forever based on the money we've saved for you for your pension. We're going to start letting you invest some of the money, put it out into the market. You're going to be able to be the one taking on that risk, letting it grow. And again, supply and demand sort of thing, as you're not able to get nearly as much on that that money sitting in the bank, that money starts to flow out of banks, and we start to see those rates come down to push more of that consumer mentality, if you will. We also saw the advent and widespread use of things like credit cards. Mm-hmm. We start to see more car loans, more student loans, and we started to become much more of a borrowing society that way, at which point, again, supply and demand, as those interest rates come down, more and more people are looking to bring that money in and along with, you know, what they're going to do for current lifestyle rather than for future lifestyle.
Yeah, so it was a combination of that shifting in perception, but also, if I'm hearing this right, maybe taking that retirement saving, that saving in general, making it more of that consumer basis and almost more privatizing it as opposed to making it more of a larger scale industry.
Yes, yes, very much so. Very much so along that way. And as we saw in that savings, the savings account interest rates, we saw go at a very slow and quite frankly kind of steady drip over the course of time. And yes, there have been over the years some ups and downs, but really we're talking very mild ups and downs. I mean, really, if you take from 2000 through 2011, the average rate is about 3.6%. It was actually all the way down to about 1. It had been up to about 4 at one point early, and then, you know, we saw some spikes here and there along the way. But for the most part, a very slow, steady pace down. The stock market, though, does ride a much wilder swing in that same time frame.
Yeah.
So, for example, we go back to that 1970 to 1985 time frame. Our interest rates up over 10% in that time frame. The actual S&P 500, and I like to use the S&P because it's got a wider swath. It looks at 500 companies, whereas that Dow Jones that we always hear about, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, that looks at 30.
Okay.
So 500 companies, a much bigger swath throughout the actual economy. From 70 to 1985, it actually averaged less than 1%. It averaged a 0.7% annual loss in that time frame. So over that 15-year period, you're actually a net negative. So that $10,000, if you invested it in something that followed the S&P in 1970, by 1985, you're down to $3,300 in there. So you're like, ooh, big risk involved with that.
Maybe at that point, go back over to the bank.
Right. Because the bank at that point is paying 10%, yeah. Right? A very safe option in there. Also a very predictable option. But we hit the mid-80s. From that 1986 through 1999, our interest rate at the bank was averaging 6%. The S&P 500 in that set of years averaged over 26% annual growth. So that $10,000 in the bank that would have grown to $20,000 in that time frame, well, your $10,000 in the market that's following the market grows to $200,000 in that time frame. So not just growth, we're talking exponential growth. Because again, rule of 72 still applies.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm averaging 26%, that's basically every 2.5 to 3 years my money has doubled,
yeah,
in that time frame. So we get multiple doubling periods versus one doubling period. That takes us to that 2000 through 2011. And in the equity world, in the investing world, we actually call that the lost decade. Because, again, we're talking 12 years here. And in the stock world, you actually were basically flat over that entire decade, those early 2000s. You averaged a 0.3% annual loss in that time frame. Because it starts out with your 2000, 2001, 2002.com bust. Then we see the 2007, 8, 9 implosion of the financial world. And we finish with the, well, we might be starting to think about this, but we're starting to linger in a recession at that point as well.
Not to mix in a global war on terrorism, just kind of in the background of everything.
Yes, in the background of everything. There may or may not have been a terrorist attack and subsequent, you know, armed engagements happening at that time as well.
A limited skirmish, as some would say.
Yes, yeah, that's one way to that's one way to describe it. Just a different spot in the sandbox,
yeah,
right? So that's that decade. So your $10,000, had you put it into something that followed the S&P in 2000, by 2011 is worth about $7,000,
okay,
a little bit north of that. So again, a rough decade, if you will, in that world. But we then come back to our last 13 years, basically, 2012 through, I actually did these numbers on Tuesday this past week. In that time frame, the S&P 500 averaged 13.3% annual growth. So that 10,000, if you started with that number again in 2012, had we put it in the bank in 2012, we have about $11,000 in 2023. Had we invested it in 2012, we see something that follows the S&P 500, about $45,000 in our accounts. So part of that, things that matter, things that don't matter, is we've got to look at and think about that long-term picture, right? If you look over those last 53 years, and why do I pick 53? Well, because 1970 is a good round number, and a lot of folks who may have started working around 1970 are now at that retirement age, about 50-ish years of work. In those 53 years, your interest rates have averaged at about 4%. In those 53 years, your growth rate in the S&P 500 is over 9%.
Okay.
So more than double the growth rate, which actually is going to exponentially grow dollars in that time frame. Because if you've got a 9% rate, that means every 8 years, your money is doubling. So if I take $10,000, and this is just that basic back of the envelope math, 8 years from now, it's 20. 8 years from that, so 16 years total, it's 40. Versus if I only have that 4% rate. That 4% rate is going to take 16 years to double. So $10,000, 16 years later, I have 20. So in that same 16-year time frame, investing versus just putting it in a savings account, I've got more than twice the money. And that's going to then exponentially grow. That next 16 years, that 40 becomes 80, becomes 160. The other 40 just becomes 80.
Okay.
So exponential growth. That is why, for those of us who are Gen X, millennials, Gen Z, when we think about the retirement years, investing actually matters. One of those crazy pieces. Folks, we are up against that first break in today's show. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what part of investing doesn't matter. And we're also going to get into the retirement side of life as well. Stick around. We will be right back.
Money affects each of us in different ways. Sometimes it's a source of stress and fear. Sometimes it's a source of comfort and security. Whatever your perspective, it's always good to get a second set of eyes on your finances to help serve as a guide. If you are looking for that guidance, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Welcome back to Money Matters here on KRDO News Radio, of course, presented by FRS Financial Group. Rick, we've been talking about investing and why that ultimately matters. And
right.
Kind of that intentionality of actually getting in and investing somehow. Because as you mentioned, instead of just dumping it into a savings account, digging your head in the sand versus actually putting it into some form of investment, even if it is just a basic fund that mirrors, you know, the S&P, you're going to get a much better result. But when you take a look at that, and when we look at the what matters and doesn't matter, that's also where you need to shift your mind as well a little bit, because when you're making these investments, you know you're planning for that retirement. So you kind of have to have that 30,000-foot view and really pay more attention to the forest rather than the trees.
Exactly. Because there are certain things when we actually look at the world of investing, when we can say, you know what, this part of it doesn't matter. And one of those parts that doesn't matter is that very short-term perspective. One of the things in our world when we are looking at, okay, how is my portfolio doing? Today does not matter. Right, we are recording this on Wednesday, October 11. What happens in your 50 years of putting away money into a retirement plan? October 11 of 2023 doesn't make a hill of beans difference. One day does not matter. You are not going to get to your retirement day and say, boy, if I had just done something differently on, and you know, pick a date, August 14th of 2006, this would have all been different.
Yeah, and you've had some pretty good statistics and, you know, kind of proof that we've talked about in previous episodes that even if you're invested in that long term, even if you include the worst X days over a 20-year period, you're still going to do better than if you just sat on the sideline doing nothing.
Exactly. You know, that's the beauty of all of this, being able to kind of take a look at what makes a difference and what doesn't make a difference. And one of those things we've seen is that concept of perfect timing, right? If you bought perfectly at the low, let's say that, yes, you did get some kind of a bonus, $10,000 every year for over the course of 20 years. And you picked the perfect day to invest that in the absolute perfect lowest spot in, say, an S&P 500 index fund. if you did that over the course of 20 years, you've taken that, what's really 200,000, and made it something a little bit north of 700, if you were perfect every single time. But let's say you had the absolute worst luck in that whole thing. You picked the absolute high of the market every year that you put that money in. You're still above $500,000 at that point. That's not too bad considering you started at 200. You've actually put it in there the absolute worst possible time, and you've actually ended up with 500,000, ballparkish, right? Back of the envelope math. Versus if I just threw it in the bank account and let it sit there for the last 20 years. If I did that, I've got about $210,000 in that time frame.
So, I mean, Rick, it really sounds like it's that, you know, old adage of doing something.
Yes.
Is still better than doing nothing. But why is it then that so many people are so reluctant to just take that first stop of doing something?
You know, the big piece, and I know we've talked about this on previous shows, there's a psychology out there that says that anything that I lose, right? Mm-hmm. So if my money is down 5%, hurts twice as much emotionally as if my money were up 5%. In fact, a 5% loss gives me as much sadness as a 10% gain gives me happiness. We are very emotionally attached to our money. We're going, oh no, what's going on? How is this going to, oh my goodness, is it ever going to stop? Am I going to go all the way down to zero? And we ride that emotional roller coaster and we start making irrational emotional decisions rather than that rational, logical, long-term choice to say, you know what? It goes up, it comes down. You know what? We've seen in the last couple of months a down.
Yeah. Right?
September was a down month in the market. August was flat to a little bit down in the market. I had folks at the end of September go, oh my goodness, what's going on? Nothing. It's just one of the months in the year. And historically speaking, actually, September has not ever really truly been a really good month in the history of the stock market. I can't tell you exactly why. But September's not ever really been a good month. However, if we take a look at not the last month or the last 2 months, but we look at the last 10 years, and we've built that retirement plan that says, you know what? In order for us to get from our mid-20s to our mid-60s to be able to say, I'm done going to work, if we need to average, say, 8% growth because that's what we have put into that plan, and the last 10 years we've averaged 10, well, guess what? We're actually in a better spot.
So then how do you kind of transition that mindset of knowing that really with those ups and downs, with kind of seeing the ebbs and flows as we see on a daily or month-to-month basis, that for lack of a better term, that's all theoretical numbers. That's all plain numbers.
Right.
And the only time you actually really need to care about that is when it's time to cash out, because up until then it's all, you know, monopoly money at that point. Your wins, losses, it doesn't really matter until you reach that goal line.
Exactly. And that's one of those things where one of those things that matters is our retirement planning, right? That retirement planning is absolutely what matters. The fact that we actually do it, because what that does is it helps to give us a goal of where we want to get, and it helps us to build that plan and those benchmarks along the way, right? Because I'm sure everybody has heard in some way, shape, or form, and it is properly attributed to Benjamin Franklin, that a failure to plan is a plan for failure.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are not trying to think about what is my end goal, what am I looking at the end of the I'm done working goal? If I'm not looking at that, I don't even know where I hit the end of my map,
yeah,
if you will. But if I've got that goal in place, then we can start taking a look at some of those benchmarks along the way. One of the things I often talk with folks about is that, yes, a pile of money is a nice goal to have, but ultimately, when we get to the I don't work anymore, what we're really looking at is our cash flow, our income.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to have a certain level of income, and then we figure out where it's all going to come from, right? Those folks that are baby boomers, you've got your Social Security pretty well in check. You know fairly certain what it's going to end up being once you decide to take that, whether that's somewhere between 62 or maybe it's on the far end at 70. You've got a pretty good idea. For us Xers, for the millennials, for the Gen Z folks out there, it's not going to look the way it will look today once you actually log into your Social Security account. The number you see there is probably not the number you end up with.
Yeah.
Because things are going to have to change. In my generation, Social Security is only about 75% funded. So I tell folks, whatever number you see right now, expect something, but probably not even 75% of that number, because what that number on the website tells you is if you continue to earn and grow your earnings over the years like you have recently, this is where it will end up. You know, if you're like me and you are 15 to 20 years out before you hit retirement, the number you see today might actually be the real number, because you can go, okay, if I got 20 years from now and it's never growing again, that might be the actual number I end up with. If I get more, that's great. But in my own planning, I just take that low number and say, this is what this piece of the income is. Now, I've got to go plug in all of those other pieces of the income that I plan to have in my retirement years. Whether that's, you know, if I've got rentals, if I've got my assets. For some folks, if they are in the military or they are teachers or they work for the sheriff's departments or something for local government, they may have a pension. That pension is going to generate a particular amount of income. We count that, right? We just have to make up the gap between the known money coming in and what our assets are going to have to provide for us in that time frame.
Yeah, and then that's also where you need to have that long-term perspective, because we've seen other times when it's investing, and usually this is more on those kind of smaller side, but you have those people, how long do I hold on? How long do I hold on? How long do I hold on? And worried that either something might crash or the sky would fall. And that's where, if you're really making these sound more stable investments, you don't have to worry about that, because you are kind of baked into a larger group to make up for one sector or one certain stock have outperforming or underperforming, and you can really follow that market trend as opposed to trying to time just a certain effort to really make that giant jackpot.
Exactly, exactly. We're not out spending that $20 to hit that $1.7 billion on the Powerball.
Yeah.
By the way, if anybody in the listing area happens to hit that, I know a good financial advisor who's already got a plan in place in the event somebody wins the lotto to make sure that your money doesn't hurt you in that long run. I happen to know a guy, Andrew.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is, one of the big pieces we want to look at, and again, this is where that plan comes into play, we want to look at what kind of risk can I take on in my 20s versus my 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, right? Because as I get closer to that retirement world, typically I want to pull back a little bit on my risk, understanding that, no, I'm not going to ride that down nearly as far on the roller coaster in the event of a pullback. I'm also not going to fly nearly as high in the event we see stuff like we saw earlier this year, and quite frankly, through the year, because we're up a little over 13% on the year coming into today. We're not going to ride that all the way up. You know, there are folks that are up, you know, 7, 8, 9% at this point, simply because we didn't take all that same risk on. I can't tell you how many folks who were getting ready for retirement when 2007, 8, 9 hit, and they actually took a 45 to 50% drop in their portfolios. Mm-hmm. And my question is always the same. How close were you to retirement? And if you were within 5 years, why were you aggressively invested? Because that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You're getting close to that finish line. And if you really needed that extra push to get you there, you probably had too short of a goal in mind.
Yeah, you probably weren't as close as you thought you were.
Exactly. Exactly. So again, that's where that plan comes into play. And, you know, all sorts of different pieces, you know, in there. One of the things I typically tell folks as we kind of think these things through is if, let's say, you need $100,000 for your retirement lifestyle, whatever that looks like, the rule of thumb is a 4%, what I call burn rate. You're going to use 4% of your assets as your income in that retirement life. So that tells us what amount of assets we need. 4% burn rate, if you need $100,000, means you need $2.5 million in your portfolio if that's the only thing generating income. If you don't have a pension, if you don't count on any Social Security, if there's no business to sell, if there's no rental income, any of that, you're only counting solely on your investments, you need $2.5 million. And if you're 50 and just starting, that's a very daunting task.
Yeah.
However, if you are, say, 25 years old and you're just starting, I've done the math, Andrew. I've done the math on this. If you're 25 years old and you're averaging 10% on your annual returns and you want to retire at, say, just throwing the number out there, 65, right? So 40 years here. If you put away $5,000 a year, oh my goodness, for a 25-year-old, that's just a little over 400 bucks a month.
Mm-hmm.
At 25, you might be able to afford $400 a month going into some sort of a retirement, sort of a fund, because you're probably, if you went to college, now you're out of college, you're working a job. This might be, you know, for those that went straight into a job out of high school, you're now 6, 7, maybe even 8 years into it. You're probably making good enough money at this point in time. You can afford to put $400 or so a month away. $5,000 a year, growing at 10% every year by age 65, Andrew, is $2.6 million.
About enough.
That's pretty close to enough to generate that $100,000. And if folks have put that in a Roth IRA, that's $100,000 that's not getting income tax taken out of it. So it's the idea of starting that early, right? At 25, it's not nearly as daunting as doing that when you hit 50,
mm-hmm.
right? Because at 50, I've either got 15 years of putting away a whole heck of a lot of money, or I'm not retiring at 65.
You got a lot more working ahead of you.
Yes. Yes, a lot more working ahead of you. Speaking of ahead, we are going to take that final break in today's show. But when we come back, we are going to look ahead, Andrew, at what matters when it comes to leaving a legacy.
All right.
So, folks, stick around with us. We will be right back.
Does stock market volatility have you wondering which way is up? Do the talking heads and doomsayers have you wondering if this really is the end? If you want straight answers from an advisor who isn't just trying to sell you something, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment today. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC.
Well, folks, thanks for sticking with us through that break right here on Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group on KRDO. Rick Stevens here with Andrew Rogers. And Andrew, as we were headed into the break, we were talking about what is actually one of my favorite parts when I'm sitting down talking with folks, and that's leaving a legacy.
Okay.
And I want to start with a legacy. A legacy matters.
Yeah.
Now, what legacy you leave doesn't necessarily matter as much.
And let's, you know, take a quick, you know, just maybe, I don't want to say full step back, but maybe sidestep.
Sure.
What is it, you know, how do you define leaving a legacy?
So I'm going to go full Evan on you here.
Oh, great.
I'm going to tell you that it depends.
Okay.
So that legacy that we leave, a lot of times folks, when they think about legacy, they just think about money or things they're passing on that are material. I like to think more of this as what have I poured into my kids, my eventual grandkids, maybe my siblings, my nieces, my nephews. What is that I will be remembered for? And hopefully, going from that, I'm going to draw back here into that Gen X machine. It won't be like the Three Amigos trying to be infamous. It will just be famous.
Yeah.
What am I famous for? You know, maybe just in my own family. So it's what are you remembered for? Ultimately, is that legacy? So yes, there are some things that you could think about from the material side, but I like to think about, you know, one of those things that I would like to leave, that I hopefully am leaving as part of my legacy, is teaching my kids how to steward the resources that are put in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, I don't always get the credit for that. There may have been a time or two, there has been a discussion at my house with my children, and they've come up with a wonderful statement about legacy, making a good financial decision, but some other bald guy with a beard was given the credit for that, you know, because Dave Ramsey says this, but they forgot to say, well, Dad also said that.
Well, and that could also be part of that, you know, wide definition of legacy, because I'm sure the even initial point to listen to Dave Ramsey didn't just come on their own, and that comes
right
from more of those Bound Rock foundational, you know, kind of legacy stones that I'm sure were imparted by Mrs. Stevens.
Well, you know, at least one of the two of us walked them through Dave's foundations in personal finance course.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he may have been the one on the TV, but somebody else was having that discussion with them. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I'm just saying. But, you know, looking at that concept, that idea of leaving a legacy, and this is oftentimes what I tell folks. I said, if you were to just do this, if you were to just take, you know, a sheet of paper, the back of an envelope, whatever, and you start writing down generations, right? You start with your name on the top.
Okay.
And you go one generation back. You can write down the name of a parent. Most of us can get to the name of a grandparent on there. Some of us get to the name of a great-grandparent, but typically speaking, unless we are those kind of folks that like to know the family history and trace those roots back hundreds of years, that's about as far back as we can go.
Okay.
Which means my great-grandfather passed away in 1970. If I remember my great-grandfather's name, but not my great-grandfather's name, who passed away in 1950, within 100 years after my death, my name will be forgotten somewhere along the line.
Unless you really do something big to impart down the line.
Exactly. Or you do like some folks that I know, and they are the fourth, and their child is the fifth, and that becomes too easy to figure it out. And
okay,
I always ask that question, okay, give me a relative's name that wasn't the same name as okay yours. So had a young man, Bill Hawk V, and he was the only one that could go back four generations before him. I said, Bill, you got to come up with a relative whose first name was not William. He couldn't.
Okay.
So, but along those lines, right, we're looking at what is it we can do to leave that legacy. Making sure that you are being intentional is what matters.
Yeah.
Now, you've got all kinds of ways to do that. There absolutely is that. We've got, you know, X amount of material wealth, and we're passing this on one generation to the next. And then we've put all these bells and whistles in place in the estate plan to ensure that this money stays intact in the family over the years, and we're making good decisions. Sometimes it's as simple as something like life insurance. So that, you know, hey, nobody in their 30s and 40s thinks they're going to die anytime soon. But that possibility exists. There are folks in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who die every day. One of those legacies that we don't want to leave is that burden on those that are left behind with how in the world are we placing that income back into the family. If we don't have something like life insurance, we make things much harder for those that are left behind. There are some folks who have put life insurance in place not because they have kids, because I have clients who have life insurance but no kids, because if they pass before they have grown assets over time, they want to leave a legacy to certain organizations.
Okay.
They have organizations that they have listed as beneficiaries because they've got something in particular, some kind of legacy that they want to create over the course of time. So what matters in leaving a legacy? Well, a legacy is important. What legacy is not nearly as important as saying something is going to be remembered about me? Is it going to be good? Is it going to be bad? We've got to realize we all are leaving some kind of legacy behind us. Now, when we sit down to try to figure out what do we want to do, that again comes into that whole planning aspect, that whole planning perspective. What do I want to leave as a legacy? What's it going to take for me to be able to leave that as a legacy? I've heard folks say, you know what? My kids don't need to get anything. I want the last check I write the day before I die to bounce. I get that. I want to spend all my money. I want to enjoy my money. But I am of the belief that a good person leaves an inheritance for their children's children. Right? I've looked multiple generations down the line, and I'm thinking about those folks that I'm going to bless on down the line. So what can I put in place? And maybe it's that last check bounces because it was the last check in my personal account because the trust account has everything else at this point in time.
Okay.
And, you know, that could be kind of fun. I've seen the bumper stickers that say I'm spending my kids' inheritance. I try not to do that, just knowing that, well, A, I've got a couple kids, and, you know, I'd like them to get more than $50 each.
Well, and then that's the other question is, you know, how do you then, you know, do that, but, you know, can I know that balance knowing you want to make a legacy, but you also don't want to make it a hassle or a burden on that next generation who has to split it up, who has to divvy, things like that. Because, again, another great philosopher, I know you quoted Benjamin Franklin earlier. I believe it was one Biggie Smalls that said, "Mo' money, mo' problems." So that could also be the thing of maybe they don't want to make it where it just, you know, I'm out of the picture and now it's just nothing but infighting amongst that next layer.
Yeah, that's I've had that conversation as well of, you know what, we don't really have anything in place. We'll just let the kids figure it out. And I've said that's the last thing you want to do because as a parent, you don't want to create a money fight amongst your kids. That's where the estate planning side of things comes in. That's where you get to lay out bit by bit, layer by layer, what your actual wishes are. That's why having a will is so important because you can literally write down, I want these things to happen with my money. When we're talking about things like retirement accounts, those have beneficiaries on them. The last thing, and I've told folks this before, the last thing you want to do is if you have four kids, just name one of them. No, that's the last thing you want to do. If you have four kids and you want it split equally, name all four kids as beneficiaries equally split. You can take as many beneficiaries onto that sort of thing as you want. Hey, you've got 10 different places you want it to go. You can say, I want it to go to organization X, and they're going to get 13%, and organization Y is getting 7%, and organization Z is getting 22%. You can make those things out in your beneficiary list because that is something that passes contractually to those folks after you pass, or you can put it in your will. You can put it in your estate plan. This child gets X. This organization gets Y. This asset goes to Z. You can put those things in there and you can be intentional because, again, the last thing we want to have happen is, as any parent, I don't want my kids, A, worrying about and especially B, fighting over money because I have seen in my world, way too many families where mom and dad have passed, they get the will, they see how things are divided, and the siblings never talk to one another again because of it. We don't want that. That's not the legacy we want to leave.
Yeah, but even to have that legacy to leave, you have to start with that initial plan and focus and making that first step to actually start investing and start actually building that legacy to eventually leave behind.
Exactly. We all have stuff of some way, shape, or form, whether it's a home that we live in, maybe it's a vehicle that we drive. Maybe it's a baseball card collection. Maybe we've been to all kinds of NHL games and we collect pucks from NHL games, right? Could be all kinds of anything out there. We've all got something to divide up, and having a plan is the best way to start. In fact, I will go to the wonderful philosopher General George Patton,
okay,
who said a good plan, violently executed now, is better than a perfect plan next week. We don't have to have the perfect plan to get things going. We can make changes over time. Whether that's on the retirement side, that's on the investment side, that's on the legacy and estate side. The key to that is to have a plan. It doesn't have to be perfect. We mm-hmm. can change that as time changes, right? My estate plan when I was 30 is a lot different than my estate plan now that I'm almost 50.
Yeah.
I have more children now. I have more things now. I'm in a totally different state, literally, now. I'm in Colorado. I'm not in Illinois anymore. There are certain things that are different over that time frame, but I had a plan. I've adjusted that plan over my lifetime because, believe it or not, we're not guaranteed tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. And the last thing we want to do is to have our expiration date, if you will, come up and not have any plans in place.
Yeah. And again, another quote in, I apologize, I'm taking this in the pop culture realm, but to quote Rush, if you choose to make a choice, you're still making a choice. So it's
right.
Which choice do you want to make?
Exactly. Exactly. We are all going to leave some kind of legacy. Hopefully, we actually take that time to think about that legacy, to be intentional about what it is that we want, because we're all going to leave one in some way, shape, or form.
So what's the next step?
Well, the easiest next step is to give me a call, right? 719-500-8700. We sit down. It doesn't matter if you are 20 or if you are 70, anywhere in between. We sit down. We talk about what we're looking for, what we want to do, and really to start hashing out what those plans are, so that we can put some things in place. We can get some benchmarks along the way. You know what? 5 years from now, it needs to look like this. 10 years from now, we need to look like that. Or you know what? It might be as simply as, you know what? Next week, we're actually going to sit down with XYZ folks and have the information that we need on how we're going to all lay this out. So that's the easiest way to really take that next step to do something about it. Because again, doing something much more important than doing absolutely nothing. So folks can give me a call, 719-500-8700. We will get that entire planning process underway. Folks, that is all the time we have for this episode of Money Matters. We will be back next week continuing to talk about your money, because your money matters. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.